right, everybody, welcome to episode number 31 of The Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. Today, we are going to be talking about the thyroid gland, how to expect when the dad is absent, and isolated IgA deficiency.
Since we've been doing quite a bit of stuff lately with the immune system and immune deficiencies, all that, thought it'd be good to talk about the thyroid gland. And I think recently, if I remember right, we talked about the parathyroid gland, so it kind of rolls together. So the thyroid gland is it's in your neck, and it's kind of in front of the upper part of your trachea. It's shaped like a butterfly. It has two lobes and a connecting part. We definitely talked about this because I remember talking about that very specifically with the parathyroid. We also talked about the parathyroid glands living within the fibrous capsule. Remember that? Thyroid gland has a fibrous capsule that goes all around it with sort of this fine collagen septa that create like lobules around it. And that septa is rich in blood supply and like lymphatics, nerves, and all sorts of really good stuff. Each lobule then that this septa kind of helps to create has numerous follicles, which is the functional unit of the gland. You can kind of think of them as like a nephron in the kidney, but nephron, that might be a little bit of a reach for some people. Think of it more like instead of a nephron, think of it as an alveolar sac. Because that's sort of the functional unit of the lung. The follicle is the functional unit of the thyroid. Two big things it does is it produces two types of hormones, iodine-containing hormones. So triiodothyronine, which is also known as T3, and thyroxine, which is tetraiodothyronine or T4. We're just going to say T3 or T4 because that makes a lot easier. So it makes those two iodine-containing hormones. It also makes polypeptide hormone called calcitonin. So we'll start with T3 and T4. Those are important for things like growth and cell differentiation, control of oxygen consumption, your basal metabolic rate. It affects how you metabolize proteins and lipids and carbohydrates, like all sorts of stuff. If you've ever seen someone with hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, you would know how much systemically changes with them. The calcitonin that we mentioned, which is the polypeptide hormone, that has to do with your blood calcium levels. We talked about parathyroid and the parathyroid hormone. There we go. That it is released to increase blood calcium. Well, calcitonin is the opposite side of that. It lowers blood calcium by lowering the rate of decalcification or absorption done by osteoclasts and stimulating osteoblasts. So remember, osteoclasts break down bone, and osteoblasts build bone. So osteoclasts, it slows down how quickly they break down the bone, so it releases less calcium, and it stimulates osteoblasts to build more, so they're taking calcium out of the bloodstream. And remember, parathyroid is in charge of raising the blood calcium levels. In those follicles, it has a lining of epithelium. Also called C cells or parafollicular cells. They're clear and they do things like basically neurotransmitter stuff. They're neuroendocrine cells. I actually just noticed that I got quite a bit more deep and technical there, and nobody's really going to care. What is interesting, though, is they're derived from neural crest cells if you're a med student. But the epithelium, the C cells or whatever, that's where calcitonin is stored. And then it also has inactive cells that are just simple squamous or cuboidal epithelium. And those are actively secreting, or when those actively secrete, they become tall and columnar. So it's kind of really neat that the squamous, which if you remember is sort of like an egg shape, or cuboidal, which are just a cube, when they work and are actively secreting, they actually change shape and become tall like columns. So we're going to leave it there for now. I actually have some more notes on hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism, but let's save that for next time because it does get pretty interesting to go into all those things. That is the thyroid gland. We'll touch more on it later.
Make sure you check us out on artofmedschool.com. We have a ton of more information, blog posts, any of our past episodes that you might have missed, as well as some really fun underwater photography that Mike has been working on. There's some cute photos of fish. So check us out on artofmedschool.com. All right. So, if you listen regularly, this will not be a surprise, but I am pregnant and living in the U.S. while Micah is back in the Caribbean working on school. And, you know, that's not always an easy thing for either of us. This is our first child. And so I think that there's often a lot of expectations of what having your first kid is supposed to look like, and especially, like, you know, in society with pop culture and all that stuff. And, you know, it's not how I pictured it. I pictured going to Lama's class with Micah and, you know, and picking out colors for the nursery. And, well, I'm not doing either of those things. So it's a little bit tricky to reframe what this looks like when there aren't a lot of examples in the world for you. And I think, you know, trying, you know, my best to stay positive through this whole thing, there's, you know, nobody knows what they're doing, especially this first time around with a kid. Nobody knows what they're doing. And so I think it's nice and reassuring for me to remember that. So I think it's also really important, you know, and especially, like, as I'm, you know, going through and reading blogs about, you know, whatever, that there are so many other women in so many worse situations that I can't even imagine, you know, like, you know, women who definitely don't have any sort of partner support, women that are younger than me, women that are poorer than me, and I feel super bad for them. And there's very few resources out there for women that don't have that sort of support network, and I don't know what they do. And so it's hard because there isn't a lot of that vision out there for alternate sort of ideas of what this, you know, first pregnancy, new parenting thing is supposed to look like. But I think in a lot of the things that I am reading, there is the desire for women to figure out how to make their partner feel included in the process. No, that there's a lot of that around. And I, you know, because a lot of it is just happening inside my system. You know, there's not a lot. And even if he were around, there's not a lot that he would be able to be doing. And I think that's kind of important for me to remember sometimes. I'm like, yeah, really? What would he be doing? Would he be helping you sleep? No. Would he be, you know, would he be actively helping you not have heartburn? No. But, whatever. But, and especially postpartum, when pretty much all the baby needs to do is have a boob and to sleep, there's really not much for, you know, for the guys or for the partners to do. And so, you know, so I think that there's a lot of literature out there of, like, how to make the dads feel included. And so there's so much of that out there in media of, like, what are we going to do to make dad feel included? What are we going to do to make dad feel included? I'm like, my dad's not going to be there. The dad's not going to be there. And so screw you guys. But, you know, I think that there are times that he is going to be present. And so making the best out of those moments, because I want, and he wants to feel as active as possible, even when he has to be far away and working on other things, especially in a lot of this beginning time. You know, and so we try to have a lot of dedicated time to talk about what we want that to look like. And it's really helpful for me because I have such an amazing network, especially considering the circumstances, because I don't have my partner here and I don't have a good friend network. I don't know a lot of people in this town, and I'm trying to reach out and things like that. But, you know, most of my network is family, and I could not be doing this without them. And it's so nice to have them so close and to be able to, you know, really be present. They come with me to my doctor's appointments, and it's nice to know that after this baby comes that I will have other hands to help me hold this kid and to help me raise this kid, you know, until he gets here in August. So, full time. So that's really amazing. And, part of the trying to figure out exactly what this birth plan is going to look like is a little confusing too. You know, I'm definitely one of those people in the world who like to think of herself as being like a little crunchy. I'm a little crunchy. Like, I lived in a yurt with no plumbing on an organic farm, for example. And I think that childbirth is a very natural process, and a lot of people do it. And I think that having too many medical interventions is part of the reason why, you know, the United States has such a poor infant mortality rate, especially for developed countries and industrialized nations, that for some reason that the U.S. isn't quite doing it right in a lot of the same ways that a lot of other people are. I like to think of a much more natural path, but I am totally this person that is having a planned induction, so Micah can be present. And that's all just assuming that this kid is coming really close to their due date. That's also not a guarantee. And, you know, trying to figure out, like, okay, so what's my plan B if that happens? And so, you know, I know a lot of people had their kids a couple weeks early and, you know, their kid's fine and whatever, but if Micah's not there, who do I want to be there? And I don't have a very good answer for that. And so what I ended up doing is going through and hiring a doula. And if you don't know what that is, you can look it up. They're it's kind of an interesting process, but they're pretty much like a birth coach and a dedicated person just for me that isn't a medical professional, but is a person that you go through and you can hire separately to be there for the entirety of birth and labor. So I think that's going to be a very good choice for me, especially on the off chance that Mike is not going to be present for that. And so I think having that sort of support without having to then choose, you know, having my mother there or having my mother-in-law there. And then I think that there's just a lot of weighted emotional things when it comes to that. And I've got really great relationships with both of those awesome women. But I don't want necessarily their experience, and I want to create my experience. And I think having this outside person who's only biased towards me. I won't say that they are unbiased because they are not, because nobody's unbiased, but that her bias will be towards my desires and my wishes. I think that that's going to be a very good choice, ultimately. And don't worry, I'll let you know how it goes. So That's kind of what I chose with the birth plan, since I am not having that guarantee that Micah will be there. And this is a really kind of embarrassing thing because, you know, you've got all these ideas of like, oh my gosh, I'm already going to be a terrible mother. Oh my God, this kid isn't even born yet and whatever. But like, I'm straight up not going to birth classes because I'm embarrassed to go alone. And, you know, it's kind of shameful to admit it, but it's true. And, you know, and I feel like I'm getting a lot out of some good books, and I'll have this doula there to be able to help me out. I am going to be going to a breastfeeding class and a new infant caregiving class because I've not spent any time around very small children and I have no idea what I'm doing. But I think also that I am not the first person to have had to figure this out. And so there's a lot of intuition involved. But I'm not going to birth classes because I don't want to go alone. And, you know, and I think that's also okay. Just trying to figure out. So what are some ways that I've been able to keep Micah involved throughout this process is I do send weekly belly photos that I have some fun with. I try to do like something a little bit more fun than your baby is the size of a grapefruit. I've found some fun lists where it's like, your baby is the size of a G.I. Joe action figure and your baby is the size of a Game Boy and things like that, you know, so I think that's a little bit more fun. And he's also been able to Skype into some of our most important OB visits. So he was there we Skyped him in for the first ultrasound, for both of the ultrasounds, actually. So the first ultrasound is like, look, there's a human in there and that's all going great. And then the second one is the one traditionally that people kind of think of as the gender reveal one, which wasn't that big of a deal to me, but getting much more specific weights and measures and all of those sorts of things was. And then making sure that, you know, any lists of things that he wants to include are also there. I've also been super fortunate that this pregnancy has been really easy. I didn't have much morning sickness. I didn't have many other symptoms that are uncomfortable, you know, like, yeah, maybe I'm tired sometimes, but then I take a nap and then I put on my big girl pants and I make it through the rest of my day. You know, sometimes I have difficulty focusing on stuff, but like, really, really, that's it. Like I have a difficulty focusing on things. I'm not exactly sure what my excuse was before, but, So thankfully things have been going really easy, because if they have not been going really easy, things would be a lot more difficult for me emotionally as well. I don't know. And it's helpful for me to remember that there are billions of people in this world, and each of them was born at one point or another. And just because this whole thing isn't going the way that I had planned or maybe like expected when I first started thinking about having kids, like honestly, it doesn't mean that the way that we're going about things is wrong, or that it's any harder or confusing in the process than anybody else's. And I just like to think of myself as playing this game of life at least one step up from easy mode. That's it.
We launched our Patreon account. Please go check it out. You can find a link on our website or just look up Art of Med School on patreon.com. This is a great way to support us as we work hard to make the most and best content possible. You can find more information on our homepage at artofmedschool.com. And every little bit helps. Thanks.
Moving right along with the immune deficiencies that we've been talking about. This one is kind of fun for me to talk about. It's isolated IgA deficiency, and I've really been enjoying learning about this because I was born with isolated IgA deficiency. It's, you know, not uncommon. It's actually the most common inherited B cell deficiency. It's one in 600 Caucasians. And it always really strikes me when something is specific to Caucasians, because it seems like there's just not that much compared to other races. And I'm really interested why that would be. But this one is specific, one in 600 Caucasians, and it's the most common inherited B cell deficiency. So IgA, as we have discussed, is really important for protection on mucous membranes or like any kind of secretion. So it does protection on tears and saliva. Your respiratory tract has IgA, GI secretions. It's actually in mother's milk or colostrum. And so those are all protected by IgA. And what happens if you can't protect it? It's isolated IgA deficiency. And an isolated IgA deficiency, it's what it sounds like. It's the IgA that's deficient. It's only the IgA that's deficient. There's no change in IgG or IgM or IgE. IgA deficiency, usually asymptomatic. It wasn't for me, but for a lot of people, it is. Except for, so when the big exception is when something weakens our mucosal defenses. So, like a change in the stomach pH or something like that changes that mucosal defense. You don't really have a backup system because you don't have IgA. Then you get into trouble. So the common presentation would be recurrent infections involving the mucosal surfaces. For me, I had a tremendous amount of GI issues as a kid because I pretty much grew out of it. But I had a tremendous amount of GI issues. I also had a tremendous amount of chronic ear infections. I had tubes more than, you know, I even remember. And it actually led to some neurological disorders with me. That can be a whole other thing. Actually, I'm working on a paper on that right now. Anyway, so recurrent infections involving mucosal surfaces, anaphylactic reactions to transfused blood containing IgA. Wow, I did not clarify that one at all. That sounds really complicated. So let's break that one down. It's be good practice. So anaphylactic reactions, transfused blood containing IgA. We're talking about transfused blood. That is what it sounds like. It's blood that's being transfused from one person to another person. Where do your gamma globulins exist? In the blood. I mean, like we talked about on mucous membranes and stuff, but IgA can also be in the blood because it has to get there somehow, right? So transfused blood containing IgA, the body sees that, like, it doesn't make IgA. So they're like, whoa, 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 what is this IgA stuff? And so it has an anaphylactic reaction. Anaphylaxis, that's just a hypersensitivity type 1. That's just like an asthma attack, or, you know, someone with a peanut allergy would go through anaphylactic shock. I feel like that's a common term. So, you know, you throw them some epinephrine and you go from there. Anyway, so you can get an anaphylactic reaction, transfused blood containing IgA. Sorry, when I made the note for this, I didn't realize how complicated that sounded until I said it out loud. Increased frequency of allergies, that makes sense. Increased autoimmune disorders, that's pretty much all immunodeficiencies. And diarrhea secondary to infections, I remember that. So that's isolated IgA deficiency. Kind of interesting. I think a lot of it makes sense. IgA is important for mucous membranes or any kind of secretion, tears, saliva, respiratory, GI secretions, colostrum, and that's where we end up having all of our issues.
All right, everybody, there you have it. That was episode number 31 of The Art of Med School, where we help creative minds understand medicine. Today, we talked about the thyroid gland, how to expect when the dad is absent, and isolated IgA deficiency. Our theme music, Urbanimatronica Wuya Mix by Spinning Mercata, is copyright 2011, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. This show is not affiliated or endorsed in any way by St. James School of Medicine. Micah just goes there. The Art of Med School podcast is part of the Art of Med School Network. For more information, find us on the web at artofmedschool.com.